What comes to mind when we think of stadiums in the United States of America? For most of us, it's entertainment, football games, Taylor Swift concerts, monster truck rallies, and rodeos. But as historian Frank Gritti reveals in his book, The Stadium, An American History of Politics, Protest, and Play, over the past 150 years, they have been where people gather to wrestle over defining the soul of America, from the wooden ballparks of the 19th century to today's glass and steel megastadiums. These buildings have been the public square where Americans push and pull over issues of race and class and gender and sexual inequalities. In the new book, The Stadium, Gritti writes of its remarkable role as a space of protest and politics, not just play, and tells the dramatic people's history of American life. The name again of the book is The Stadium by Frank Gritti, an award-winning historian and the author of three books. He's a professor of history and African-American studies and the executive director of the Eric Holder Initiative for Civil and Political Rights at Columbia University in New York City. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Frank Gritti to the roundtable this morning. Frank, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What brought you to write about stadiums and to have this subject come onto your radar?
Yeah. You know, it started off the way it often starts with people who get fascinated by stadiums. You know, when I was a child, my dad took me to games. As a child growing up in New York City, and I became a sports fan and fascinated by the stadium environment, the size of the venues, the crowds, the atmosphere. And so that, you know, that sort of was a pleasure that started in my youth. And then as I became a scholar of sport and its impact on society, you know, I kind of became obsessed with this question of the function of stadiums in American history. And certainly, you know, I found that stadiums are places where, as we know to this day, there are places where we go see our favorite team, our favorite athlete, our favorite concert performer. But then as I started doing some research as a social movement historian, I see that I came to realize that it plays a larger function in American history. People gather at stadiums for a host of reasons, in addition to the ones that we typically associate with them, right? To go attend political conventions that we just saw at the United Center with the Democratic National Convention last week, to go to protest something that's happening in their neighborhood or in their city or in their country, to go and gather for religious purposes, as people have when they gathered at when the Billy Graham Crusades were at their height, evangelists in the mid-20th century, right? And so I became fascinated with a wide variety of functions that the stadium has, you know, played in American history, and that became the subject of the book.
When you look at a stadium, of what makes them necessary? I mean, it's as simple as trying to get as many people in one place at one time, right?
Indeed, yes. I mean, what makes them necessary is that, you know, when the entertainment industry and the sport industry emerges in the late 19th century, you know, entrepreneurs, you know, are looking to pack in crowds to see, you know, spectacular performances, whether it was a circus performer or a baseball player. So, you know, it starts with the needs of the you know, of the 19th century amusement and 21st century sport and entertainment industries. But then as politicians and as other people saw the value of, you know, of communicating messages in a large space where tens of thousands of people gather, they fulfill this larger purpose. And I think that's what we've seen in the history of this country, right? And so, you know, we're often told that they're necessary to, you know, bring sports teams to our city, or they're necessary to generate economic development, as often argued now. But in fact, they've been necessary for a bunch of other reasons. And I think, unfortunately, though, now I think that we're at a point now where we're almost getting to a saturation point with stadiums as they continue to be built all over the country.
I want to talk about that saturation point in a moment. However, mm-hmm. before we get to it, let's talk about a statement that you make rather early in the book. Mm-hmm. Stadiums have always been political, and that's interesting. What is it about putting a stadium in a place that makes that overtly political?
Two reasons. Number one, whether they're privately financed structures, you know, as we saw in the early history of stadiums and as we see sometimes now, or if they're publicly managed and financed, is usually the case, and certainly that's been the case since the post-World War II era. You know, they're contingent. Their construction and maintenance are contingent on political dynamics. They're contingent on the funding from taxpayer dollars or whatever the public subsidy is. They're contingent on some sort of collaboration with elected officials or other political entities, you know, to make them possible. And then they become political because of the ways in which, you know, politicians and our government use them to cultivate loyalty to whatever cause the nation is being called to, whether it was during wars, as we saw after World War One, or during World War One, World War Two, the Vietnam War era, and of course, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq after 9/11, or even with our simple tradition of the singing of the Star Spangled Banner, which, you know, really takes shape in the aftermath of World War Two.
Right.
You know, that makes the space by definition political. And then, as I show in the book, they become also political because, again, you know, social movements, whether it was the Black Freedom Movement or the Second Wave Feminist Movement or the Gay Lesbian Gay Liberation Movement in the 1970s and 80s, you know, also approach these venues as places to state their claims for equality and citizenship. So they are politicized whether we realize it or not.
One of the things you address in the book and that I find fascinating about stadiums is this tug of war that often goes on with communities where a city will say, we need a new stadium, we want a new stadium, we want it to have all of these bells and whistles, here's the list of all the things that we want it to do. Then they have a fight with the city or a fight with a group, and then at some point the team or those representatives say, all right, well, we'll take our marbles and go elsewhere because City X is more than willing to take us. Is that a new phenomenon, or has that been going on throughout the history of stadiums?
You know, it really starts to take shape in the aftermath of World War II. You know, what you're describing there is what I call the kind of modern stadium scenario. You know, the scenario where an increasingly powerful or de facto powerful sport league or team commands and requests or demands and insists on public subsidies to build a stadium that is more state-of-the-art, supposedly will allow the franchise to compete and be in a better shape, you know, financially and also competitively. So that really takes shape as the sport industry grows and leaps and bounds during the aftermath of World War II. That's when you start to see this dynamic, when it was the Braves franchise moving from Boston to Milwaukee, the MLB franchise, and when the Dodgers and the Giants leave New York in 1957 and move to San Francisco and Los Angeles. It kind of sets in motion this dynamic of sports leagues and teams able to command public dollars for the construction of stadiums. And that dynamic persists to this day. And I think that's, you know, the arguments sort of change over time, but this particular dynamic is really about the story of the growth of the sport industry and its impact on our lives.
You have a chapter in the book called Corporate Temples of Exclusion. We've touched on this, but talk a little bit about what you mean by that and what the future is of those said temples.
Yeah, because these structures are more often than not contingent on the public subsidy and the collaboration of public officials, they have a mandate to serve a larger purpose, right? And I think what happens in the 20th century, the mid-20th century, you know, these buildings are seen as sort of civic spaces. There are countless memorial stadiums built all over the country. There are ways in which they become symbols of local civic identity, where, again, people gather together for all sorts of reasons, you know, everything from, you know, going to conventions or even for citizenship swearing ceremonies, as we see in Miami in the early 1960s or in Los Angeles in the early 80s, right? But then after the 1990s, they get remade into sort of these corporate temples of exclusion, as I call them, or really sort of monuments to corporate America, where naming rights deals become standard in the 1990s, where advertisers are plastered all over the stadium as far as the eye can see. I mean, in the 1970s, you know, people are arguing vehemently against the overabundance of advertising in stadiums, and that dynamic changes completely after the 1990s, right? So they've also become much more exclusive and much more catering to an affluent crowd, and we see this, you know, in most stadiums today, right? So even though these are buildings that are really contingent on public subsidies, they really are made today to serve a very, very small demographic, the 21st century American gentry. And yet, because they are iconographic and because they are accessible, you know, from a transportation standpoint, we see things what we saw in 2020. We see protests happening at the Barclays Center in the aftermath of the George Floyd murder. We see their usage as spaces for vaccinations and for voting, as we started to see in the 2020 election and in some cases afterwards, right? And so, you know, 2020 becomes a really interesting moment where we can see the revival of the larger purpose of the stadium. And my hope is that, you know, and maybe this is hoping against hope, is that some of those usages will become amplified in the years to come, because I don't think stadiums are going to go away. And I think that we're going to continually face this dynamic of sports teams, you know, asking or requesting or demanding stadiums. And I think that either we don't build them from public dollars, or we as citizens decide that, you know, we're going to insist that our public officials make them more accessible for broader purposes and to a broader public.
I grew up in the city of Philadelphia. There was a stadium there called Veterans Stadium, and it was a multi-purpose stadium. You played baseball in Veterans Stadium. You played football in Veterans Stadium. That type of stadium has gone by the wayside, and as a Veterans Stadium. There are now two stadiums that take up that real estate in the city of Philadelphia, and they're right across the street from one another. This has happened in cities across the country with both baseball and football teams having their own stadiums. More so with football than with baseball, but it's still worth noting that you're spending tens of millions of dollars, especially in the case of football, on a stadium that you're using less than 15, 20 times a year.
That's exactly right. And in fact, there's also the arena there, which, you know, has been the home of the Flyers and the Sixers, the three venues in that space,
Wells
right,
Fargo's
in South
there,
Philadelphia,
yeah.
right? Wells yeah. Fargo, and of course, the Sixers are trying to have an arena built for their purposes in downtown Philadelphia, a story I'm sure you know. Yeah, what happens is that as the National Football League grows in power in the 1960s and 70s, basically you're following what the Major League Baseball franchises were doing before that, which is to basically argue that, you know, our fans, you know, want better stadiums. They want better sidelines. They want better, you know, bells and whistles. They want, you know, they're able to see their players in ways that are with the less obstructed seats, right? That's the story of the growth of the sport industry, right? And I think that's the challenge. I mean, we've seen a central stadium building orgy over the last, you know, couple of decades now, because most of these leagues continue to advocate for sports-specific venues. And yet, every stadium is multi-purpose. Right. Well, you know, and I think that kind of notion of multi-purpose is actually a misnomer, because stadiums today, the MetLife Stadium, for example, in the suburban in New Jersey outside New York City, you know, that's a venue that, you know, certainly hosts the Jets and the Giants. But they also have things like bar mitzvahs, right, for the local community. You know, they rent out space all the time, because in order for these places to be viable, people have to come through their gates. Right. And so part of what the book is trying to show is to kind of move beyond even this kind of notion of a multi-purpose / single-purpose stadium. Because, again, those are arguments that the sports industry uses to advocate for sports-specific buildings. But, in fact, every building has multiple purposes. You know, the University of Notre Dame Stadium, you know, doubles as an academic space, right?
Right.
I actually think that that's the kind of direction that stadium building, if it continues, should go, right? So really to imagine a kind of revitalization and multiple uses of these venues, as opposed to just saying that, well, the Flyers or the Sixers need their own facility.
Two things that I'd like to ask you about before we have to go. One is about the legacy stadiums. You look at Fenway, Dodger Stadium, Wrigley Field. There are a few. And of stadiums that I just can't imagine, that have been around all of my life, and I can't imagine them going anywhere soon. And every once in a while, somebody will come up with an idea of quote-unquote improving them, and then it goes through all kinds of concerns as to, will it take away the feel of the park? Will that always be a part of the equation?
You know, I suspect so. You know, I think, well, unfortunately, we're seeing stadiums have shorter shelf lives now. I mean, if you could contrast Boston with, you know, Arlington, Texas, where, you know, a building was built for the Texas Rangers baseball franchise in 1995, and then a new one opened in 2020. We see a similar dynamic in Atlanta. And so, you know, one wonders, you know, how much we actually value the kind of environment that stadiums provide, or the uniqueness. And I think what's happened is that they've become so standardized and corporatized that there really is no sense of space in many of these buildings now. I mean, there's some exceptions, but I would say even in the baseball stadiums, which are supposedly meant to sort of evoke a kind of nostalgic past of the antique ballparks of yesteryear, I mean, they've become standardized themselves, right? So I think that the question is, can a building hang around long enough to produce a history that's actually worthwhile and not manufactured just for the purpose of building a new building? And again, can they house meaningful events for a community that's beyond, you know, watching the Red Sox, you know, win the pennant? And I'd like to think that they can, but I think that's going to be the challenge of our time in the years coming ahead.
You read a lot about Madison Square Garden in the book, but I mean, that's a fascinating story there, because I mean, as long as I can remember, there's been talk about a new MSG. It's always debated. It seems like it's always on the table, only to be taken off the table and then put back on the table.
Yeah, and MSG, of course, has been in three different sites, right? It was on the east side in its first iteration, and then it moves to the west side on 50th and 8th Avenue, and it's its current location at 34th and 7th Avenue since 1968, when that version of the garden opened. And it's been, you know, renovated multiple times and retrofitted for the, you know, for the age of the VIP setting, the corporatized crowd now. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the case of, you know, real estate in New York is super complex, right? I mean, I think there's ways in which, you know, this is not a Las Vegas or a suburbanized metropolis where there's more available space. Here in New York City, you know, it's a much more difficult proposition to build a structure. And so I think what we've seen at MSG over the years is that essentially it's been renovated, you know, to suit the kind of the crowds that attend Knick or Ranger games or other events that happen there now, right? And so, and yet it still has that iconic identity, even though the building, you know, is very different than what it was when the Knicks were in the glory years in the early 70s, or, you know, when Muhammad Ali fought Joe Frazier there at the same time, right? And yet, but so the identity is still there, but the atmosphere is very different than what it was before. And so, I mean, I feel like it's going to stay in that space for the time being, because, you know, I think it's just really hard to build a new arena in Manhattan somewhere else.
And college football stadiums are a completely different manner, are they? I mean, they're in tiny places often, where large colleges and universities, especially in the South, and they're bringing in 70,000-75,000 people every weekend.
Or more, 100,000 in some cases, right? I mean,
right.
I taught at the University of Texas Austin for 11 years, and right on the campus is Darrell K. Royal Memorial Stadium, and, you know, that facility now, you know, holds over 100,000 people.
It's a massive stadium.
Yeah. Massive structure. And that's one of the things I wanted to do in this book, is to really open up the discussion of stadiums and arenas beyond the baseball ballpark. It's actually really astonishing to see how most books about stadiums focus on baseball stadiums, when in fact, you know, circus tents and college stadiums and indoor arenas, you know, have, you know, themselves fascinating stories that warranted attention, and that's why I include them in this book. And so, yes, the college football stadium, you know, really shows how those kinds of buildings become institutions, you know, for a community, for a university, and for the surrounding community, whether it's Austin, Texas, or, you know, Iowa City, or, you know, whatever you're talking about, Norman, Oklahoma, or whatever you're talking about, right? And so, yeah, they play substantial roles in the history of those communities, because they're larger than the baseball ballpark. They usually average, you know, their capacity is much larger in many cases, certainly in the powerful athletic schools. And they played a fascinating role in the history of this country, as I show in the book, with Tulane Stadium, the stadium that existed on the campus of Tulane University for many years, which was the home of the original Sugar Bowl Classic,
right,
for the first 40 years. And it really becomes a staging ground, not just for college athletic talent, but also for, you know, the white supremacist order, the Jim Crow South, during the 1930s, 40s, until the early 70s, right? And so, you know, there I try to show the function, again, of this particular building that, you know, tends to be overlooked, the college football stadium.
The name of the new book is The Stadium, An American History of Politics, Protest, and Play. It is published by Basic Books. Frank Garidia, thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
It's a pleasure to be on with you today. Thank you so much.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Stadium. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.